Welcome to the Dense City Podcast, a show where we chat with academics about their research on cities. I'm your co-host, Becca Mayers. On today's episode, we welcome Dr. Dan Henhock, who is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology and Recreation Management at the University of Manitoba. His research interests revolve around the multiple conceptualizations of leisure, Indigenous ways of knowing and being, and the tensions between leisure, neocolonialism, and decolonization. He's also interested in issues of sustainability and climate change within recreation and leisure. We've got a bit of an unconventional episode today because we're talking about his most recent syllabus created for his class at the University of Manitoba on outdoor and land-based recreation, discussing briefly how we think about our relationship with the outdoors. So as summer's wrapping up, it's likely that you've done some outdoor recreation, but have you thought about the ways in which your recreation is influenced by colonialism? Well, in this episode, Dan explains this history, how an Indigenous lens of outdoor recreation differs, and how these perspectives and ideologies influence how we engage in, learn about, or teach outdoor recreation. So please welcome Dr. Dan Henhock to Dense City Podcast. Dan, how are you today? Thank you so much for coming on.
I'm doing great. Thanks very much for having me.
I was wondering if you could first walk us through some of the history of colonialism, but in leisure and outdoor recreation, something that's not spoken about very often.
Yeah, it's a really interesting history. And I don't think that people have really thought about the history of colonialism in relation to leisure. There's been a few scholars who have written on the subject specifically, but it's not a really broad conversation because I think very often the history of colonization is very much equated to a lot of the overt acts of oppression that occurred in the past. And particularly something like the residential schools is something that's very tangible that people can read about and learn about and know that it happened because there's evidence of that happening. And then there's been discussions about what happened in residential schools. So, for example, you know, the introduction of European games or European sports or the European values and philosophies associated with those games and sports. And so then there's been quite a bit of discussion around that. But I think what's really interesting and something that I've been interested in for a while is just trying to understand the connection between sort of the idea of what leisure is and trying to connect it to what's happened historically through colonization and then how it's sort of has been brought into the present. One of the things that I've sort of been, I guess, attached to for a number of years is trying to understand sort of the different ways that leisure has been conceptualized in relation to sort of Indigenous cultures and Indigenous ways of knowing and being. And it's taken me a while to sort of wrap my head around it because I've always come from the perspective of having been trained in sort of understanding Western leisure from a Western perspective. And then, you know, in the past maybe decade, actually being introduced or reintroduced to some of my cultural teachings, as well as sort of the discussions around Indigenous culture in general and Indigenous critiques, I guess, of Western knowledge. So one of the things that has been really interesting to me is just trying to think about how we think about leisure conceptually, you know, all the different ways, you know, it could be thought of as in relation to free time, thought of in relation to a person's mindset. And obviously, you know, thinking about it in terms of activities has always been sort of front and center of how we, I think, broadly and popularly think about leisure, but then trying to juxtapose that with sort of Indigenous ways of being in the world. And I always draw upon an academic's work by the name of Karen Fox, who wrote a bit about sort of the juxtaposition between Western notions of leisure and indigenous culture, and you know how fundamentally sort of the misconstruing of indigenous cultures was connected in a lot of ways to how people thought about leisure and work. And I know there's always discussions around that sort of that dichotomy of work and leisure, but really, I think from my perspective, those ideas and those ideologies around leisure and work have been so fundamental. So we can go all the way back to, well, at least from my cultural standpoint, you know, I'm Haudenosaunee, I'm a Gunungahaga person or Mohawk person from the Six Nations Reserve, and our history goes back, you know, in dealing with colonization to, you know, prior to the American Revolutionary War, and then, you know, really through that conflict and then how we came out on the other side of it, you know, we were affected in a number of different ways by sort of the colonialism that was occurring at the time period. But you can clearly see through some of that history, the ways in which settler colonial society was actively trying to assimilate indigenous cultures. You can see in that history where notions of work, notions of private property, notions of how to properly engage on the land and engage in things like agriculture were fundamental to sort of the colonial project. And when you think about those histories in sort of conjunction with people's ideas around how to organize your day-to-day life, you know, there's a whole history that is connected through the, you know, beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, right up through sort of the really oppressive policies of both the United States and Canada in relation to Indigenous peoples, and you know, how governments were utilizing things like the rule of law and democracy and education to really change Indigenous peoples and gain access to Indigenous resources and lands. So I think one of the fundamental things, and I think this is the challenge of thinking about leisure and colonialism, is to move beyond sort of the overt actions, such as residential schools or even the creation of policies through governance, but to think about the values and the motivations behind what was driving settler colonialism in the first place, and then trying to make those connections between leisure and colonialism within that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the ways that I was reading in one of the papers for your course was this interesting concept of just camping and how people came over from Europe and we now had kids trying to participate in leisure outside of school and parents outside of work. And camping became this idea to make sure that kids didn't become, quote, soft. And they feared that kids would just become soft because they didn't have to work hard labored hours with, you know, children's rights now. And people assumed that when kids moved to the city, they'd become soft. So they had to send them off to go camping because camping was where you became hard by living off the land, and like all of these prejudice and stereotypes of indigenous ways of living were used by people in the city to then say, go get hard off at summer camp and learn how to fish and then come back, you know, a man, and all of these, you know, oppressive stereotypes used and appropriated by people in the city. What are some of these ways that we've conceptualized leisure from a colonial mindset? And then how does this differ from an indigenous lens and perspective on leisure? Like, is there even this separation of leisure and work? And, you know, how is this viewed?
Well, it's interesting, the history that you mentioned around the history of the Scouts movement and things like Outward Bound. You know, there's a whole history connected to the change in quote unquote Western society, the change of daily life, moving from sort of an agrarian society to an industrial society, from people migrating from rural areas into developing urban areas, as well as then changes in sort of ideas around family, gendered roles, notions of masculinity. And those are all wrapped up in, again, the histories of settler colonialism and imperial expansion. And when you think about those histories related to imperialism, particularly, so much of it was about, again, gaining access to land, gaining control of the, you know, what was conceptualized from a Western viewpoint as resources within those areas. And also then the control and the taming of the populations who were there, plus the colonial populations, right? So the imperial center, you know, what we think in historically was Europe and Britain particularly. And so much was done to sort of support that empire. The fundamental, I think, driving force behind that was, again, thinking about land as being something to be controlled or conquered. And that notion of what land was in fundamental conflict with sort of an indigenous way of knowing and being in the world. So indigenous ways of knowing, and I think this is, again, one of the hardest things to sort of wrap your head around is fundamentally around the idea that we are the relations that we have. So what that means is our relationship to the land and all the things within the land basically determine who we are as human beings. So an indigenous perspective would say, you know, these things on land, in the air, in the water, in the cosmos, all have a consciousness or a spirit, and they impart knowledge to us if we live in sort of a respectful and reciprocal relationship with those beings. So that understanding of the land and engaging with the land and all of our relations is fundamental to sort of an indigenous ideology around land and how to engage on it. And so that was, I think, in fundamental conflict with settler colonial perspectives that really saw land as something to be controlled and conquered, which then led into the whole Scouts movement and Outward Bound movements and camping movements, because the idea was with the change in sort of society, there was this fear, right, that particularly young boys were losing their masculinity, that they weren't, as they were moving to urban centers, they were not continuing on with the skills and the knowledge that they had acquired, which, funnily enough, or, you know, ironically enough, I think was very much drawn from the interaction between settlers and indigenous peoples. If you go back far enough in sort of the colonial history, particularly in North America, you know, that engagement between settlers and indigenous peoples, I don't think it was always oppressive a relationship where settlers were immediately trying to control indigenous peoples. There was sharing of knowledge, sharing of information, sharing of technology, but then it morphed into something much more insidious as, again, sort of imperial powers start to spread across the land. Or how this is connected to leisure really revolves around how people are supposed to engage the land and how settlers particularly viewed the land at that point in history. Again, we have to put ourselves in the people, in the shoes of those people at that time, where you've got this grand expanse of land and resources, and you've got all this technology that has changed, and you've got all this hope and promise of something different and better. And thinking about the land and your relationship to it, I think was fundamentally altered from maybe what it might have been previous to colonization. So then the question is, you know, how does that affect something like leisure? That's really fundamentally what I'm trying to get at with in our course, is to help students to understand that those contrasting ideas.
What does a decolonized form of outdoor recreation look like, or even just recreation period?
Yes, and that's a fundamental question of the course. It first starts with understanding how things like outdoor recreation and how we've conceptualized it is inherently connected to our notions of the land, and also then how that is connected to histories of colonization. Again, that whole discussion around how Western society has viewed land and how we're supposed to engage with it and on it has been front and center of that discussion. And I think has really directed how we think about things like recreation and engagement in outdoor recreation on the land. And similarly, that was all born out of sort of the histories of outdoor education and environmental education. Again, seeing the land as something that is incongruent with sort of indigenous ways of knowing, or that it's something to be controlled and conquered, is sort of front and center of that. So then when we think about outdoor recreation and we think about, you know, the things that we do, you know, in terms of activities, I think we often think that those things are rights, that, you know, the types of activities, you know, whether it's something as simple as hiking to canoeing, to going out on mountain bikes or anything like that, that we have a fundamental right to do those types of things, but we don't do them in regards to how an indigenous philosophy might have viewed those activities. Those activities and those things have been born out of sort of a Western ideology of how to engage on the land. So I think a decolonized notion of outdoor recreation fundamentally has to attend to the idea of relationality. So Sean Wilson, who wrote an excellent book called Research is Ceremony, within that he talks about, again, the idea of relationality as being front and center of how we sort of develop our relationships with the land, right? And so the more we engage and the more that we understand our relations and the knowledges that are there, then the more our understanding and our respect with the world increases. Another discussion by Kay Wang Yang and Eve Tuck, where they talk about decolonization as not being a metaphor, is, I think, also fundamental. So what they talk about in that article is the idea that decolonization gets utilized as this metaphor for everything that we want to do. So we want to decolonize education. We want to decolonize, I don't know, government processes. And very often, though, that notion of decolonizing things maintains sort of a settler colonial understanding of the world, because it doesn't change our relationship to the land. It maintains that relationship, but says, well, as long as we maybe include, you know, some indigenous cultural element, then we are decolonizing this thing. But it doesn't recognize that fundamental to what decolonization is and what indigenous scholars and anti-oppression scholars have been writing about in relation to oppression and decolonization is that decolonization is fundamentally about the returning of land and the reconstituting of indigenous cultures through their relationship to the land. So if we were to, you know, take seriously those perspectives or those arguments, then I think a fundamental question is then, how does that affect something like outdoor recreation and leisure? Can we really have a decolonized form of outdoor recreation if it doesn't attend to the idea that decolonization is fundamental about land and sort of that repatriation of land and culture? How do we think about that? And then how do I impart that with my students? Because so much of it is ingrained in us around, you know, what leisure is and what outdoor recreation is and should be, and how we should engage in it. And it takes a bit of work, I think, to get people thinking differently. And I, as much as I would hope that my students at the end of the course walk away with the understanding of indigenous race relationality, it really is just sort of an introduction to a different way of seeing the world and a different way of knowing.
I also came across this concept of NAR communities, which stands for Gateway and Natural Amenity Regions. And I was struck by the research on sort of managing these tourism destinations that are often in indigenous lands or right at the edge of it. trying to deal with things like overcrowding, traffic, affordable housing, increased cost of living, like you were talking about, and all of this pressure on land and the environment. So I was wondering if you had any research or have been thinking about the ways that municipalities can work with indigenous communities and sort of manage these destinations, kind of how do we move forward in that way?
I have come across some discussions around sort of the pressures of outdoor recreational pursuits within the indigenous context in sort of areas outside of urban areas. A lot of that focus has been on sort of an indigenous people's engagement in outdoor recreation and then how that engagement benefits the community and provides them with the ability to have input around, say, the preservation or the conservation of the lands that they live. The question, however, though, is what benefit do these activities have for Indigenous communities? And I think in the current society that we have, there's a lot of benefit that could be brought to in the Indigenous context. Everything from, you know, economic opportunity to increases in housing, hopefully increases in affordable housing, again, depending on the area and depending on how many people go to that area. But I think that's almost, again, the wrong way to sort of think about trying to solve the issues that are sort of plaguing Indigenous communities in these areas, because it doesn't, again, fundamentally challenge our relationship to the land. It commodifies land and it maintains this idea of consumption of the land in various forms. And even if we are trying to engage in very eco-sensitive outdoor recreation, there are still impacts that extend beyond maybe that area. Again, if we were to fundamentally shift our way of knowing and being in the world and maybe either embrace some Indigenous teachings around that, then maybe there are solutions to the issues that we're seeing in the Indigenous context or the rural context or the remote context that, you know, maybe fundamentally change how we engage in those areas. I do wonder about, you know, in regards to the discussions around climate change and the what we're beginning to understand as imperatives. You know, the imperative right now that I'm understanding is that we have to stop our burning of carbon. We have to stop the usage of fossil fuels. And so if that is the imperative, then that's going to affect a lot of different things. Everything from car usage to flights to get around the world to the types of materials that are produced for outdoor recreation to maybe even the mindset of, you know, what we can and can't do in these environments in relation to things like wildfire risk or floods or everything of the like. In the immediate term, the status quo of economic development or the promise of economic development might help to solve some of these issues. And they, you know, certainly they can be embedded in policies. I think they already are in some ways. But I think until we can fundamentally change how we think about our engagement on the land, it might just continue the same cycle. You know, I think it's similarly to the discussions around poverty, right? Like poverty is an outcome of the global capitalist ideologies that we have created our societies around. And until we actually fundamentally change that mindset, then poverty is going to continue. And I think in the same thing with in the Indigenous context.
Yeah. Even, you know, using the sort of decolonization as a metaphor, it's just going to continue to be a metaphor if it's not fundamentally changed. I also wonder what gaps there currently are in this work or in this space, and what would you suggest researchers or planners go about studying or working on next in this regard, if they're interested?
There is already lots of work being done around maybe the mitigation of climate change issues. There's certainly lots of work being done around the engagement of Indigenous communities in various practices, you know, be it, you know, sports related or health issues around physical health or issues around mental health. You know, there's lots of sort of health research out there. I think the gap, however, and maybe for the recreation field, is again, how do we engage in recreation differently, or how do we think about it differently that brings in histories of colonization and brings in histories of Indigenous knowledges and what that might look like in the present context, and discussions around decolonization. Again, what we just talked about in relation to thinking about decolonization is the repatriation of land. But then how does that actually, what does that actually look like in the present day circumstance? You know, like people might construe that as being, well, settlers need to go back to where they come from. But that's not productive. It's not possible. And it's not something I think is desirable. But what is desirable is people to fundamentally change how they think about their engagement with the land. And so much of that has been rooted in sort of settler colonial understandings of the land. Again, connecting it to capitalism, connecting it to, you know, its religious underpinnings, connecting it to things like the histories of education and democracy and the rule of law, and how those all worked in conjunction to place settlers in a position of power over Indigenous peoples and their ways of knowing and being in the world. So for me, the gap is there. How do we rethink and reconceptualize, how do we recreate our notions of recreation and leisure in relation to those discussions? And this is my own surmisation, is that, again, climate change is going to force us to think about that. Again, we're just seeing so many changes in the world that I think it's hard to ignore. And the impetus, though, is that we need to act a little bit quicker, both in academia and in the outside world, that we actually have to take seriously how we are living in the world. It's going to be a major change. You know, we engage in outdoor recreation, we engage in leisure, again, in ways that is very detached from an idea of being in relationship with the land. Even though, you know, we engage in forms of outdoor recreation that are on the land, or we engage in forms of outdoor recreation that, you know, satisfy some need or some desire to be out in the environment, but it doesn't satisfy the need of actually developing that relationship, that relationality. And so the question, I think, is, and the gap is, how do we build that? How do we do that? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think engaging in recreation in the outdoors is often viewed as a form of escapism.
Yes.
And leaving the self, or leaving the world that you're currently in, and finding this form of escape.
You know, that's exactly right. And so when I started my PhD, I took some traditional gardening classes. So we were learning about Haudenosaunee traditional gardening. And not only was that around sort of the techniques and some of the knowledges, the plant knowledges that were, you know, being handed down to us, but it was also about philosophy, which also speaks to our Haudenosaunee philosophy, which is that you have to have a good mind when you engage with our plant relations. In Western society, there's a dominant narrative, I think, that people, because we don't utilize gardening for subsistence per se, people who do engage in gardening do it as almost a form of recreation, as a form of relaxation. You often hear people say, well, you know, after I've been gardening, you know, I've I lose all my stress. You know, it leaves me, you know, I through that act of gardening. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. However, if again you believe that those plant relations sort of feed off of your emotions and your feelings, then you have to respect those entities. So the idea of a good mind is that you can't go into the garden with your stress, because those plant relations will feel that, and then they won't be able to provide for you the way that they would if they're stressed. And so that fundamental shift of thinking about how to be in the world with a good mind and how to live in it with, in terms of relationality, I think is fundamental to how we could maybe shift how we engage in the world. It will hopefully also shift how we engage with each other as well, because if we're thinking about, again, how do we engage in respectful, reciprocal relationships, then maybe that shifts our idea that, you know, an individual is only afforded help, you know, if they ask for it, or if they fit within the system of, you know, policies and other types of structures that are in place to help that person. But if we think about ourselves as being having reciprocal relationship with each other, then maybe that shift will then get people realizing that we have to help each other, right? And then the other thing I was thinking about was, if we engage differently in outdoor recreation, we also have to sort of think about how do we engage in work on a day-to-day basis. We have to go back to living where we work. You know, so often people don't live where they work. You know, they commute in by car by, you know, in an hour or half an hour. You know, there's very not many people who actually live and play where they work, so to speak. And maybe if we did that, we'd have more opportunity for to develop these notions of relationality, not only with the natural environment, but also with with each other.
Well, that's it for all the questions that I had today.
Well, thank you again for having me. This is wonderful to have this chat. I love talking about leisure. I love talking about, you know, how do we decolonize it, so to speak. And I think we're in a spot where recreation and leisure is positioned really well to help us adapt to the changes that we're seeing in the environment, and the changes that we're seeing both in, you know, politically and economically. I just hope that you know, it speeds up a bit more that this idea of that comes out of indigenous knowledges around relationality and living with a good mind and engaging in respectful and reciprocal relationships, maybe it gets pushed forward a bit more. You know, we're starting to see it a bit in discussions around reconciliation and processes of reconciliation, but I think there's still a bit of ways to go yet, because I think people are very resistant. They want to hold on to our leisure. They want to hold on to what we can currently do, with misconstruing that we can actually make it better than what it is now if we were to attend to these things. So that's my hope. And I hope, you know, for everyone who's listening, you know, contact me and we can cuss and discuss more, because I'm really, really quite passionate about this. And hopefully we'll see lots of changes, good changes coming up.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Dan, for coming on Density, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
That's it for now, and thank you so much for listening. A big thanks to Dr. Dan Henhock for joining us on this episode. Be sure to share and subscribe for updates on future episodes. Feel free to contact us on Twitter or Instagram at DenCityPod to keep the conversation going. A special thanks to Emily Huang of Emily H. Illustrations for creating the artwork for this podcast. You can check out more of her work by following the link in the show notes. Another thanks to Reed Kai and Ryan Kinnear for the show music. See you next time on Dense City.